Hello and welcome to the Flight Free podcast, the place for uplifting stories, grounded adventures, and enlightening reasons why not to fly. For the next 25 minutes, we hope to inspire, inform, and entertain. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Kirsty. This month, we're exploring the question, can we fly carbon neutral? So Rachel, what do you think? Can we fly carbon neutral?
It's something that I've thought about a lot. Who would have thought 20 years ago that we'd now have as many electric cars on our roads as we do today? So I think that with technological advances, and also I feel like the desire to travel and travel quickly will always be there. I think as the pressure for limiting carbon emissions increases, which obviously it needs to, more resources will be put into finding a carbon neutral option. So I do think that in the long run, yes, we will probably get to a place where we can fly carbon neutral, but I guess obviously we need to be doing that now, and so it's just coming a bit late. What about you, Kirsty? What do you think?
I guess the main thing that my mind jumps to is the fact that flying is such an energy intensive thing to do because of how the laws of physics work, and it's going to be really difficult to have flying or aviation in the way that we know it now with renewable technologies, because nothing renewable is as powerful as jet fuel. So I think if we do fly carbon neutral, it's got to be soon, as Finley will talk about in our interview, but it'll probably look very different to how we know it, with like much smaller planes, much shorter distances. So we've got to be prepared for a big shift in how things will be.
So before we say hi to Finley, let's clarify a few technical terms.
Flight free fact.
Carbon offsetting means the process of trying to reduce the damage caused by releasing carbon dioxide into the environment by doing other things that remove carbon dioxide. So for example, planting trees is one of them.
Carbon neutral. This means that if a person, organisation, event, etc. is carbon neutral, that means that they do things to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by the same amount as they produce them.
Carbon negative means reducing or absorbing more carbon dioxide than you produce.
Net zero is a term which can refer to, for example, a country or a city. Reaching net zero, or having net zero as a goal, means a particular place, such as the country or city, will remove as many emissions as it produces. The UK has a legally binding target to reach net zero by 2050.
And greenwash. This is saying something to make yourself look and sound environmentally friendly, but not actually having integrity in your wider commitments to the planet.
So let's meet Finley.
Hey, I'm Finley. I'm an ex-aerospace engineer. I've spent eight years working in the aviation sector, designing future aircraft and engine concepts for the next 10, 20, 30 years. I quit my job the middle of last year, the middle of 2020, to focus on the climate crisis and to focus on campaigning for increased regulation of the aviation industry, which I think is super important up ahead of the COP26 summit, which is happening in Glasgow this year in my home country of Scotland. I'm the founder of a social media channel called Green Sky Thinking, and it shares information about the realities behind what it will take to make aviation sustainable, and it's advocating for that increased regulation of the industry.
In February 2020, the UK aviation industry pledged to make flying net zero by 2050. A lot of this is going to rely on technology, so let's kick off by asking Finley to explain a bit about hydrogen planes.
If you look, in September last year, Airbus said, we're unveiling these hydrogen aircraft concepts. We're going to fly them in the next 10 years. They'll be ready by 2035 for commercial flight. And it's because hydrogen is this great store of energy. So that's true. But however, hydrogen exists as a gas in atmospheric conditions. So it takes up a big volume. And if you think about hydrogen aircraft, you probably think of the Hindenburg airship. Now, obviously, it had safety issues, but the other thing that's obvious is it's just a huge volume. So it had to fly very slowly to stop having drag. So what you can do with hydrogen, to get it more compressed, you could turn it into a liquid, and this compresses it way down from its volume as a gas. But it's still about four times the volume, even in its most compressed liquid form, it's still four times the volume of jet fuel. And the other issue is you have to cool it to minus 250 degrees C and put it at high pressure. And that means you need like vacuum tanks to stop the really cold hydrogen touching anything. And also it needs to be in this cylindrical tank. Now, this is a design nightmare if you're designing an aircraft, because the way aircrafts work today is they have all of their fuel in their wings and the fuel tanks are the same shape as the wings. And that helps you actually in your design for a bunch of reasons. It helps with like wing vibration issues, for example, but it also just means you've got a very efficient aircraft tank. With hydrogen, you've got these cylindrical tanks. If you've ever seen a pressurized tank, like a bit like a fire extinguisher, you've got tanks that shape. So you can't put those in the wings. So you end up kind of putting it in the body of the aircraft, and that means you can't have as many seats. Or it means you have to make the aircraft bigger. So if you have a look for hydrogen aircraft in Google Images, you'll see these very bulky-looking aircraft that look sort of twice the size, so that you've got the same number of passengers, but you've also got room for all this hydrogen. Now, the problem with that is, firstly, either your aircraft stays the same size, but you lose passengers. That just means all of those passengers are going to have to pay a lot more for their tickets. Or you make the aircraft bigger, and then you increase the aircraft weight. That means you burn more fuel. This means you need more hydrogen again. And also, you've got a bigger volume. That creates more drag, and the aircraft needs to burn more fuel again for the same number of passengers. So all of these things basically mean that the cost of flying is going to get more expensive. So there's a few factors to this. Firstly, hydrogen is expensive to make, because we discussed it's very energy intensive. The next thing is that the aircraft are going to take many million, I'd say billions to design. That's not that cost is going to be passed on to the customer. And then also when they're flying, they're limited because they constrain how many passengers you can carry, or they make your aircraft worse. So the thing about hydrogen is, yes, it is possible. It's not against the laws of physics. We could have hydrogen aircraft, but it's going to be very, very expensive. So it will need to be it will be more expensive to fly. We will need to fly less. We'll need to basically admit that it's going to get more expensive to fly. We're going to also have to fly slower, because these aircraft get higher drag, so it helps to fly slow, and fly less far, because hydrogen's penalizing when you carry lots of fuel. So I'm very advocate the industry plan for this and start thinking about, actually, we need smaller aircraft, smaller airports, we're going to fly a lot less far. They're not really planning for that, though. So they're talking about hydrogen and they're not really planning for it at the minute. And then the final thing with hydrogen is, like, they haven't even designed and done the early demonstrations on it yet. I know, even if you are working on a very conventional aircraft, burning conventional fuel, but it's just a slightly different configuration, it takes the best part of 10-15 years to, because basically it'll take about 5 years to design the aircraft, then you do demonstrator testing for a few years, you do development testing, you need to do all of the certification testing to show that there's no safety issues, which takes about 5 years as well. So if you just start looking at the time scales on this, 2035 is like pretty much the absolute soonest. And then even if you think then that's one aircraft into service in 2035, it'll probably take another 20 years if you wanted to convert all of your fleet as quickly as possible. You're then way past 2050, you know, and then the aircraft going to be there for the next 20 years burning fuel, and you've got all these. So hydrogen, we should be working on it, but it's not a solution to the climate change problem, because what matters with climate change is what we do this decade.
Okay, so hydrogen planes clearly have significant drawbacks, but what about the electric planes?
So basically, yeah, you basically have batteries on board. They discharge electricity that runs an electric motor that powers the propeller, that powers the plane. So it's much like having an electric car. The actual running the plane will produce no emissions. Obviously, that also, like electric cars, It depends on where you're getting your electricity from in terms of total emissions. And also, there is an environmental impact of creating electrical components and creating batteries. So we certainly shouldn't, we also just, you know, it's not like, as with electric cars, we also need to reduce the number of those that we're making. We don't just want to have a license to make as many of those as possible. The other thing, just on a kind of basis of thinking about electrical consumption, I'm a bit of an engineer, so I think of these technical things, but just for context, I think anyone should be able to understand this. If you look at global energy consumption, it is about more than 15 times our current renewable generation. So we consume 15 times the amount of energy that we can currently generate with low carbon sources. And actually, most of our low carbon electricity at the moment comes from hydropower, which can't really be scaled because you need specific places to put that. So a lot of people think we're doing a really good job scaling up solar and wind, and it is going up massively. But for context, we only produce about 2% of our energy with wind and about 1% with solar right now. So we've got a long way to go before we decarbonize our energy consumption. Now, this is really important because you start thinking, well, we need to not just scale up solar and wind, we need to reduce our energy consumption. So if you're flying, even with an electric aircraft, this is important because if you fly somewhere, it is more efficient to go on the ground, to be, and particularly if you're in public transport, particularly if you're on an electric bike, but equally an electric car, an electric bus, and the more people you've got in there, an electric train is even more efficient. So it's always better from an energy consumption perspective to stay on the ground because you don't have to lift yourself off the ground. Now, this is then important because you look at what electric planes are capable of doing. And basically, because of batteries, batteries can store, they're like 40 times worse than jet fuel at storing energy, which means you need a large amount of batteries to get the same amount of energy as jet fuel. The other problem with batteries is that when you discharge them, they don't lose their weight. Whereas if you're flying with an aircraft with jet fuel in it, you're burning that off as you go along and your aircraft's getting lighter, and that means you have to use less energy to stay in the sky. So electric planes have those two things against them. And what this means is I can guarantee you will start to see some electric aircrafts certified for commercial flights in the next 10 years. I can also guarantee you they will likely be carrying less than 10 people and they will likely be flying sort of less than 1 hour. Maximum, you might have 20 people flying for 2 hours, but I doubt you'll even achieve that. So they're very limited in terms of number of people they can carry and how far they can go. And when you start thinking about that, you start thinking, well, that's range where I can take the bus or the train or drive in a group of people. And so what I'd say is electric aircraft do have a role though. So for example, if you were going to go to a remote island in like Norway is one of the first countries where you'll see this, and there's a lot of mountains and it takes a long time to get somewhere by bus in Norway. So it would make sense to fly in those instances. But what I'd say is it doesn't make sense to have electric aircraft buzzing around everywhere, like carrying people to places when there's good public transport infrastructure options.
And what about biofuels in that case? Are they really bio?
So it's important to say, like, the aviation industry is making this a massive, like, cornerstone fundamental pillar of their sustainability strategy, is what they're calling sustainable aviation fuels, as you say. Now, the reason they call it also sustainable aviation fuels is a bit of a marketing thing, right? Because it's got sustainable in the word, so it must be sustainable. Well, actually, if you look at their plans, and actually, can I just say something? They've committed to working on these alternative fuels for the last 15 years. They've been working on them. It's not like a new thing they came up with now. They back in 2005, they're talking about scaling up alternative fuels like biofuels. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the history of them doing that, is they've continually made promises about percentage of aviation fuel that will be replaced with biofuels, and they've consistently missed that target by massive factor. So at one point they did plan to have like a quarter of all fuel by like 2020, and actually the reality is now, after 15 years, that it's less than 0.01%. Okay, so the first thing is their track record on delivering to these promises has been so bad, it's unbelievable if you have a look at the graph. So why would you believe them about the next 20 years? That's the first thing. Then the next thing is, to some extent, it's actually quite good they've missed the targets, because these fuels are actually very damaging. So when they talk about sustainable aviation fuels, what they really mean is biofuels, pretty much. There's synthetic fuels as well, but really they're really talking about biofuels, because biofuels are cheaper than synthetic fuels, so they want to use as much of that as possible. Now, the problem with biofuels is it uses biomass, so it's plants, it's material, so you can get waste. You could either grow crops directly. So obviously, if you grow some corn, that will be taking CO2 out of the air to grow the plant. You then harvest that plant and you can turn it into ethanol, or there's a load of different ways of doing it, which all get very complicated and difficult to understand. But the basis of it is you either grow plants and turn that into fuel, or you use waste products from plants that you're growing for something else or from your farm, or you could take waste that people have chucked into the bin. You know, if you collected a sort of that brown bin that's got compost waste and you put all of that, you could turn that into fuel. Equally, you can go into the drains of the sewers of cities and you'll find like clumps of oil used cooking oil, people pour down the drain, and you could use that, right? And then they'll say, well, that's carbon that we haven't taken. The big problem with global warming is we've extracted carbon that's been stored over millions of years deep underground, and we're putting that into the atmosphere. So if we're using carbon that's already in the atmosphere, you know, it's a plant or it's cooking all the stuff that we've already made, we're not adding anything net to the atmosphere, is the argument. But what you have to do is you have to look at the scale involved here. So there is, you will be able to find some used cooking oil in the drains, and you can use that. And you're right, if you just use that, that would have a good impact. But the problem is there's just simply nowhere enough used cooking oil in the world to even service a small percentage of the consumption of aviation every year. And that's also true if you look at any of the other biofuel sources. What you understand is if you needed it on the scale of the aviation needs it, you'd basically need to cover like all of the land that we currently use for growing food in biofuel crops. So just for context, Mike Berners-Lee has written a book called There's No Planet B, which is really good and I really recommend. And he says in there, you know, if we produced enough biofuel for aviation industry alone in wheat, we'd need to use like all of the calories currently grown for humanity. And bear in mind that the human population is growing. It's 8 billion, it's going to grow to 10 billion. Bear in mind the aviation industry is planning to grow by 4 times to 2050 and probably triple its amount of fuel. That's just not possible, right? It's just basic maths. And it's certainly not possible to even do a fraction of that without adversely affecting other things, such as deforestation, land grabs from people, particularly in the global south. Even if you use farmland that's already been deforested, you're impacting food prices for people that could least afford it elsewhere. And basically, when you do the analysis of the land change for biofuels, because what it usually does result, we've got a history. It's not like you can look back over the last 10, 15 years, 20 years, and biofuel has been massively scaled up for road transport, and it's had a devastating impact on Malaysia, Indonesia, places in South America. It's caused a huge amount of deforestation. So many areas of land already covered in palm oil. That really affects biodiversity, but also it just actually causes a really bad change in land use emissions, which actually means often biofuel is worse than using fossil fuel. So I like something I'm very, very clear on with people is the aviation industry should not be talking about biofuel as a solution, but they are, I can tell you, relying on biofuel.
Wow, it sounds way more complicated than I thought. I mean, I thought that it's just really easy to assume that technology will save us. You see so many adverts, you know, promising that you can fly aeroplanes on banana skins and so on. And it's something that I really want to believe. But Finley just has made me realise how much more complex it is.
Yes, yeah, it's definitely an interesting area of discussion, isn't it? Because clearly we haven't solved the problem yet, and even though it is being advertised as, you know, that you can fly carbon neutral already, obviously we can't yet, and hopefully one day we will be able to, but we need to be able to do it now, not in the future.
It's, I mean, the thing that surprises me as well is that this is just when we talk about like the fuels and the aeroplane designs without even touching on carbon offsetting at all, which is itself filled with loads of problems. And it's just so easy to look at what the aviation industry is telling us and think, oh yeah, you know, that's how things actually are.
We actually did a podcast episode in last year's series about offsetting with Dr. Roger Tyers, which gives a great rundown of why carbon offsetting is not actually the solution. And there's a link to that on our podcast page of the website.
There's loads of problems with offsetting that I learned about from that podcast episode and from chatting with Finley. I mean, even though tree planting's great and it's what most people think of when they think of carbon offsetting, it's really difficult to calculate if trees planted will at some point in the future absorb the amount of CO2 that your flight emits today. Yeah, it's just a really difficult one to work out, and it's not something that we can bank on when we need action now and we need to reduce emissions now.
Yeah, so true. So while we're talking about trees, that's a good segue into our destination of the month, I think.
Destination of the month.
Because this month we are talking about woodlands. As we're moving out of winter and into spring, what better place to go than a woodland, potentially full of bluebells. So Kirsty, what is your favourite woodland?
Well, I grew up in London, and my favourite place to go to feel like I was in the countryside was Epping Forest. It's on the central line at the very end, so you can get there from the city centre quite easily. And it's just a magical place to be. There's enormous old oak trees. You can escape the sound of the city and just walk through completely unhuman-shaped environments. So that was my salvation when I lived in London. But there's also forests all over the UK, so I'd like to have two, if that's possible. And my second is the Forest of Dean, just for the amazing history. It's got the wild horses that live there, the culture of people who live in the forest and tend the land and have legal rights there. So yeah, those are my two. What's yours, Rachel?
Of course you can have two, and what wonderful choices. Okay, so mine is a little bit different. I'm going to go for a woodland in Cardiff, which is where I grew up. The Taff Trail is a trail that runs alongside the River Taff, as the name might suggest. And there are offshoots into sort of various different woodlands along the way. And one of them is a woodland that surrounds Castle Cock, which is in Tongwynlais in Cardiff. And the castle is like a sleeping beauty castle, and it's surrounded by these beautiful woods, and it's just quite a magical place to be. So that is my favourite woodland, and top tip for visiting Cardiff.
Cool. It sounds a dream. So now this month's podcast recommendation. This month it's The Wild podcast, which I just find really escapist. It covers so many different things, from forest bathing, forest therapy, walking, different histories relating to nature and herbalism. And it's just a really good way to dip a toe into all the sort of things that a person can be interested in when they take themselves out into the natural world. And you can find that online if you search The Wild Pod in your search engine.
And now, to conclude, we asked Finley if he honestly thinks we can fly carbon neutral.
No, certainly not. Certainly not today. Because the only way you could do that was as electric or with synthetic fuel. But both of those things take electricity. And at the moment, electricity isn't carbon free. So if you're flying, you're increasing energy consumption, and that's the opposite of what we need to be doing as a human race on this planet right now. So I'd say no, it's the answer.
Okay, so that's pretty definitive. So it sounds like the only way to reliably reduce our emissions is to reduce demand, and you can do that by signing the Flight Free Pledge.
Yes, please sign up to our pledge. To do this, you just need to go to our website, which is flightfree.co.uk, and you can sign up online.
Thank you so much for joining us for this month's episode of the Flight Free podcast. We are really excited about what's coming up next month. Rachel and I are going to be handing over to other members of the Flight Free team, and they're going to be discussing racial justice and climate justice and the interconnections between the two. It is crucial listening for anyone interested in climate change and the issues that this raises for people all around the world. So thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us then. Bye.
Thank you for your company at this Flight Free podcast episode. We hope you enjoyed the journey. You can find out more about the campaign at our website, flightfree.co.uk, or find us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Flight Free UK. Until next time, stay grounded.